Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. Today, we're going to be taking a look at Peanuts 1952. I'm Jimmy Gownley, creator of Amelia Rules and The Dumbest Idea Ever. My latest book is Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up, and I'm one of your hosts on this deep dive into the world of Peanuts and Charles Schulz. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, the writer and executive producer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, former vice president of Archie Comics and creator of the Instagram strip Sweetest Beasts, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
And composer for the band Complicated People, as well as for this podcast, and cartoonist behind Strange Attractors, Tangled River, and A Gathering of Spells, Michael Cohen.
Hello.
Well, guys, it's great to be back with you here in Peanuts World, talking about another year, 1952. Things are really happening in the world of Charlie Brown and Charles Schulz. The cast is expanding. The gags are getting sharper. We see lots of first appearances of favorite themes and motifs and characters this year. So, Harold, why don't you tell us a little bit about where we find our hero, Mr. Schulz, as 1952 begins?
Yeah, well, Charles Schulz has been living in Colorado Springs, Colorado, in the previous year. At the beginning of this year, he and his wife, Joyce Halverson, they're just about to make a move. So during this year, they are going back to the Minneapolis area, which is more Charles Schulz's stomping grounds. And that's a big change for him. As we said last year, he became a father at the time. He got married in April of 1951. And then on February 1st, 1952, he becomes a father, this time of Monty Schulz. And this is all happening right around the time they're making this move in the wintertime, early into the early spring, back to Minneapolis from Colorado Springs. Things are taking off for him. Schulz had a little bit of a community in the St. Paul, Minneapolis area. His father still was living in the area, was still working as a barber, as I understand it. And Schulz already had a bit of a friend family at the art instruction schools, which he was continuing to work at. But now, instead of doing it long distance through Colorado Springs, he was getting to see those people in person again. And also, the church that he had been attending after World War II was finding a new small home. I think it could seat about 40 people, and they had broken ground just before Schulz and his family return, and they become, particularly Schulz, becomes very involved in that little community. So his own little family is expanding. He's going back to see old family and friends, and he has a community, and you really see that, I think, in this year strips. There's a tremendous amount of growth in Schulz, because as a loner, this is probably the least lonely time he's had in his life. And he's seeing lots of people that he likes and that he loves. And he's you can see him processing this growth of being amongst other people, other strong personalities and people who he cares very much about, and they care about him. And his world is expanding. You really do see it. At least that's my impression. And things are happening for him as well professionally. The first Peanuts being printed outside of the newspaper comes at the very beginning of 1952. United Features Syndicate had their own comic books that they published since the late 30s. And so he appears in Tip Top Comics 123 and United Comics 21 in the March-April 1952 issues. Being a huge comic book fan, I bet that was a thrill for Charles Schulz to see his strips in color and the comic book form as well. And then the first reprint book of the strips themselves, simply called Peanuts, is also published in 1952. So he's moving up in the world, and I think, as we're going to see at the very beginning, the very first week, his first Sunday strip appears as well. So a lot of things are happening at the beginning of 1952 for Charles Schulz.
Absolutely. It is definitely an expanding world for Mr. Schultz. And I agree with you. You can see that in every frame of the strip as the character. It becomes much less insular and much less just about gags and much more about this, you know, group of people that he's creating to interact with each other. And yeah, like you mentioned, lots of big things happen this year. Michael, what can we look forward to as we talk about 1952?
I see Schultz is entering a pretty experimental period where he's established his main cast, but he's trying different things. And some of them, as I'm sure you'll hear about later in the podcast, are a little strange and don't seem to work. Schultz realizes it and drops these immediately. But there's some very odd strips this year, including him trying to work out Snoopy, who, if you heard the last episode, you'll remember that Snoopy is pretty much acting like a dog, a normal puppy. And occasionally, Schultz will drop a hint that he's actually way beyond that, that he can understand, possibly read, and even says a word. And we'll soon see Snoopy turning into more of the character that we're all used to. And a lot of that happens this year. So we're starting out with the main five characters who were established in...
So that's Charlie Brown, Patty, Violet, Schroeder, and Snoopy at this point, right?
Shermie, who's kind of a nondescript character... And actually, one of the first characters in the strip is still around. Now, the Schroeder was introduced last year as a baby, which seems to be Schultz's way of bringing in new characters. There's a new little kid who quickly grows up to be roughly whatever age the rest of the gang is. But when we start off, there are these six characters, and there's going to be a couple of big introductions this year.
Who are we seeing? Do you want to give the spoilers or are we going to wait till we get there?
No spoilers.
All right. We'll wait. No spoilers for early 1950s comic strips. Not here. Not without ample warning. for me, what I'm really shocked about with this whole thing is how quickly he becomes just a really, really great cartoonist.
Yeah.
Flawless drawing. Amazing design. Sometimes he's struggling with maybe Charlie Brown's head at this stage. That's a thing that happens when you design a character and you have to draw it millions of times. Sometimes it weirdly starts going in these directions you're not even aware of and you have to sort of rein it back in. But he's just a great cartoonist. The line quality is beautiful. The lettering is sharp. The design of every panel looks great. It's just a joy to look at.
Definitely. And detail. We're seeing detail like we haven't before, more often. And that's a really interesting development for him. And given, again, he's between two communities. I think he may be in three different houses this year, starting out in Colorado Springs. Then they moved to 5521 Oliver Avenue South in Minneapolis, which still stands. And it's it's basically a new suburban area. It was built in 1949. So he's now got another little suburbia with shallow lots and they're just there, I think, temporarily while they get their footing again in Minneapolis. And then they move one more time by the end of the year with their expanding family. Is one thing I didn't mention that does affect Schultz at the very end of this period is that not only did Monty get born in February 1st, 1952, but Craig Schultz is born in January 22nd, 1953, which affects some of the last Sundays and daily strips that he's drawing, a month or two in advance.
Yeah, a lot is happening for our boy Charles Schultz. And, it's interesting when you talk about him being a part of these two communities, both, the Church of God group and the Art Instructions group. I don't know much about Minneapolis in the 1950s or St. Paul in the 1950s, but I don't think too many people are crossing those groups and are able to just interact and be in the inner circle with both of those groups. They seem like they would probably be mutually exclusive, but Schultz is right at home and in both of those worlds, which I think, speaks to what he's able to do later in the strip, which is just sort of end up being something that everybody could find a little bit of themselves in.
And I think he's really embracing a social life, unlike what we would see for most of his 50 years of growing peanuts. The fact that, you know, he had these friends in Colorado Springs, but he was kind of starting fresh out there before Joyce's world. Then they come back to St. Paul, and he's in Minneapolis, and he has what are instruction schools, so a lot of the same interests he does professionally, and he's mixing in that space. And then from what I understand, he becomes a member of the church board and an adult Sunday school teacher almost immediately on his return. So he's making some real social commitments that are not typical of what I think of Charles Schulz when I think of like his later period, where he would almost describe himself as a bit of a recluse. You know, he didn't like to go out. He didn't like to travel a whole lot. I think he felt the pressure of expectations on him a lot. But in this period of his life, you know, he really is the common denominator in the social. He's not living off of Joyce and her friendships. I mean, she's not particularly thrilled about going to the church, and yet she's very involved. They're having friends over and Thanksgiving dinner and expanding the table with their expanding family and friends he knows don't have a place to go. He's really being very proactive socially in a way that shows a confidence his dream job of being comic strip artist is now a reality, and he's creating his own world. And I'm just thrilled for him when I see these things, and I see it in the strip. He's just growing so much as a person.
Well, there's something you need to consider, though. Assuming that Charlie Brown is the Schulz representative in this cast of characters, and with sharing a first name leads one to believe it, the transition in this year is pretty clear of Charlie Brown from kind of the Joker, the practical Joker character that was more prominent in the first 2 years, into a pretty miserable kid. And I don't think it's very typical in comic strips in any period to talk about depression, but that comes into quite a lot of the strips this year.
Yeah, there's definitely a transition from what we saw the previous year. There's a strip I think we'll talk about later where he's I saw that. I was looking at that, Michael. I was like, this is a different joke that Schulz is pulling off in 1952 than he was doing in 1951, based on Charlie Brown's character. But he's also holding his own against the other characters. That's another thing I see. It's a carryover from 1951. Even though he has insecurities and Schulz is willing to show Charlie Brown being insecure, which is so unusual in the comic strip, he's holding his own with the other characters. You know, they're not always getting the best of him. And sometimes he's coming across looking as the most reasonable character. So there's definitely transition here. And I think that makes this really early period in Schulz's strip super fascinating, because things are happening really quickly.
Yeah. But there is sort of a downward trajectory to his mood. You don't see that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, we look at it from the outside and we say, well, you know, he has this comic strip and that's fantastic. His new book's coming out. He's got a family. He's got all these friends. And having that amount of social interaction is also strange, not just for Charles Schulz, but for a cartoonist. Because you have to like drawing and writing and yada, yada, yada. What you really have to like is being completely alone most of the time. That's really what your number one thing is as a cartoonist. So maybe what we're seeing from the outside and go projecting on it and go, well, that is happiness and success. But maybe from the inside, he's saying, but I still don't feel like I fit in. You know, maybe Charlie Brown isn't reflecting the external realities of what anybody else would see happening in Schulz's life. But it might be a little bit of what he's feeling still inside, despite the outward success and happiness.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really interesting insight, because one of the things that I'm seeing is he's willing to point out his own shortcomings. And sometimes those shortcomings, through Charlie Brown anyway, are that he sees himself as perfect, as somebody who's very well considered. You know, he's not going to say something if he hasn't really put some time into thinking about it. But he's also bragging about it, which makes the other characters miffed at him. And so he's deepening and becoming a richer character in the Charlie Brown character.
But in particular, Schulz has Charlie Brown drawing comic strips in a couple of episodes this year, which, I mean, even makes it even more biographical. I mean, it can't be biographical, but it's definitely a clue.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Everybody eventually has to do that, right? Where every cartoonist eventually has the idea, oh, what if one of these characters was a cartoonist, right? It happens in Bloom County. It happens in Garfield. No, I don't think anyone knows this or remembers this, but John, the second main character in Garfield, Garfield's owner, was originally a cartoonist.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Some idiots do entire memoirs about it, like if anyone would care about that. So there's always that thing where someone goes, what if one of these guys was a cartoonist?
And for those of you wondering what that self-referential joke was, Jim is the author of The Dumbest Idea Ever Published by Scholastic's Graphics Imprint. It's absolutely phenomenal, and you should check it out.
It's at least okay, I would say that. but that definitely is another clue into the linking of this. You know what? You mentioned, Michael, that he shares a name with Charlie Brown. Uh-huh. I think I was a reader of Peanuts for 25 years before I even really noticed or thought about that.
Same with me.
Oh, really? Okay, good. I'm glad I admitted it then. I don't feel too bad. Okay, so that's basically where we are in 1952 with Charlie Brown and Charlie Schulz. So why don't we take a break here and then come back and go in deep on the strips. All right, we're back. Again, I'm Jimmy Gownley. I'm here with my co-hosts, Michael Cohen and Harold Buchholz, and we're talking about Peanuts 1952, where Charles Schulz is expanding his universe, expanding his cast, and expanding his horizons. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at various strips throughout the year that we think are either funny or interesting, or maybe it's a first for a character or a theme or a technique. And we're just going to chat about it back and forth and see what we think of our favorite comic strip here in the early days of 1952. So right off the bat, January 1st, Michael pointed out here that this has the first appearance of Zip-A-Tone in a Peanuts comic strip, which for cartoonists out there is a very exciting moment, I imagine. Should I explain briefly what Zip-A-Tone is?
Sure, go ahead.
Why, of course you should.
All right. Everybody wants to know what Zip-A-Tone is. All right. Well, when you're printing in a newspaper and you want to have grays, there are no true grays. So what Zip-A-Tone is a sheet of adhesive, you know, backed plastic, which has dot patterns printed on the top in different shades, 10%, 20%, 30%, or maybe a pattern of rocks or bricks or something like that. And then the cartoonist can cut out a little section with an X-Acto knife. And when it prints in the newspaper, the dots are close enough together that it'll make a gray. Schulz doesn't use this hardly at all for the first several decades of Peanuts. It'll pop up now and again. But later on, I think as his tremor got worse and the art became a little more abstract and rough, he used it again to sort of give some form and dimension in places in the art. But this is a really early example, which he does not go back to very often.
And it's part of Schulz's development of more detail in his strips. This particular strip, for those who get a chance to see it, shows one of the most detailed houses I've ever seen him draw in Peanuts, and with a snowy kind of type of a setting. And it's just really interesting to see this beautiful, simplified art style just building out a little bit from what it started out as the year prior.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful strip. It's a really beautiful drawing. This one in particular is some beautiful drawing that definitely has more detail, more shading on the snowman in the last panel. The one thing I would just remind everybody, if you want to follow along, you can follow along at gocomics.com, where they have a version of Peanuts in color from the beginning called Peanuts Begins. And if you really want to get in deep, I recommend getting the complete Peanuts volumes from Fantagraphics, which are still in print and available. You can get them from whatever retailer you buy your fine books. So anyway, that's Zip-A-Tone. Now you know everything you've ever wanted to know about Zip-A-Tone and less. All right, and now we have another exciting first, a huge first, actually, what happens on January 6th. Michael, what is that?
Well, we have the first Sunday comic, which is going to, it would have been in color and would be probably half a printed page of a newspaper.
Yeah.
Gave him a lot more room, a lot more panels, and seems to be a whole new way of pacing a joke, pacing a story. So I think, it's just my opinion, but I think these early Sunday pages, Schultz is trying to find his way. His timing is always impeccable, but it seems to me that in these early Sundays, they're a little scattered. Like they don't have the right rhythm that leads up to the punchline. And later in the year, I think the Sundays are much better than dailies. But right on this first one, if you look at January 6th, it's a bunch of kids running around, and the point of view keeps changing. And I don't think he's quite got it yet, but he'll get it soon.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. One thing, even later in his life, Schultz always said, was that he felt that the Sunday strips needed to reach a younger audience. Which is why often later the Sunday strips would feature Snoopy and Woodstock and things like that. But even back as early as these things, I sort of see that. Like in this one, this is a very simple kiddie type of gag. It's based more on the visuals of watching the kids run around and stuff. And it's even a physical little bit where Snoopy bites a hole in Charlie Brown's pants in the last panel. As we go forward, I'm going to read the daily strips so you have an understanding of what we're talking about. It's a little harder in the Sundays, so we're just going to sort of summarize them. And this is, it's just basically a gang playing tag, with the joke being Snoopy is also playing tag with him. But I don't know if that came from the syndicate that said the Sunday strip has to skew younger, or if that was something Schultz just himself believed.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. We're looking at the very first strip he does. Apparently, he did a little bit of a mathematical error when he was trying to plot this thing out. The bottom line of the strip, either Schultz or someone at the syndicate cut off just a little fraction of the strip, and it cuts into his signature and the date of the strip. And you can kind of see where Schultz probably was working an extra quarter inch down, and it just didn't fit the dimensions that he needed. The comic strip, everything is the same panel, so you can make a cube out of it, or a 2x2, a 1x4, a 4x1, however, for the daily strip. And then at the Sunday strip, I believe the top tier entirely can be removed. You can take out that whole top tier of the Sunday strip, so it has to be a throwaway couple of panels at the front. And for all I know, there was even more difficulty in having to design this beyond that. But from what I can tell, it looks like either you ran it with three tiers or two tiers, and that's it, based on how he breaks up his panels.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we should definitely explain that for people who aren't familiar with it. Yeah, there were limitations placed on cartoonists for Sunday strips, and well, I imagine they still are today for whoever is still doing a Sunday comic strip in the newspapers. But yeah, the idea would be the whole top tier could be removed so that the newspaper could just run two-thirds of it if they wanted to. So the cartoonist every week had to come up with sort of a sub gag for those top two panels, one of which panels also had to contain the name of the strip, and it had to work with that included or without that included, which is a real pain, and something that the earlier cartoonists, you know, guys like Hal Foster or George Harriman, who had the whole page, they didn't have to worry about.
And in this strip as well, you can see the first time out doing a Sunday is working smaller than he winds up working. The line art is kind of similar to what you see on the comic strip itself, but it's a little bit thicker. That would suggest he was working small, and it's just reduced less than the daily strips we've been seeing before. But in just like a few weeks, the lettering and the line actually becomes thinner than the daily strips, which suggests he's working much bigger as a Sunday strip artist.
That's another thing I guess lay people don't consider or have any reason to think about, but the size you work really affects the way the work reproduces. And like, you know, for standard like comic books, which is what I've worked in my whole life, you're drawing on 11 by 17 to basically print something that's 6 by 9. And what happens is things tighten up and they seem a little slicker and a little more professional. But when that ratio is off, like Harold is explaining, it will make it look like the line's perhaps a little thicker than it should be or a little thinner than it should be. All right.
One other thing I should mention about 1952 that I neglected to mention earlier is this is the year where Charles Schulz has his best Albert Payson Terhune gag.
Wait, his best what?
Albert Payson Terhune.
Oh, I cut that. I cut that, man. Too weird. Too weird.
Albert, so Snoop, it's just one of the strips early on where Snoopy is bringing a book for Charlie Brown to read, and it's always Albert Payson Terhune who wrote the book like Lad a Dog. Always.
Oh, I thought he was some kind of a religious writer, like a.
No, he was a writer most famous for writing about dogs.
Oh.
So I thought that was.
Now, I had it in there weird because only an adult would know this, but apparently it's a kid's book. So.
Well. That's funny. And what I used to go around telling my friends, hey, you're no Albert Schweitzer. I had no idea what I was talking about. But anyway,
Dog was not exactly like on the bestseller list when this came out. It was written in 1932. So Schulz is reaching back two decades to his childhood. But it's a funny sounding name, you know, not knowing anything about it. Just the fact that there's a character that Snoopy is bringing for Charlie Brown to read Albert Payson.
And that's the punchline.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it takes a lot of guts to do a joke knowing that maybe the majority of your audience isn't going to get it. And
yeah,
I'm a proponent of doing that and that you have to do that because Michael just was delighted by that joke that Charles Schulz wrote in 1952. Didn't get it. I didn't get it either until right now. But now the joke went off. It's hilarious. That's why you do those sorts of things. Now, no editor wants you to do that. I'm sure no syndicate wants you to do that. But, you know, keep it simple, making sure everybody in the world is going to get this. Schulz does not do that and still managed to do something that was completely popular with the whole world.
70 years later.
Amazing. March 3rd, Charlie Brown is sitting outside playing. He hears a voice from off panel. 1-1-1. He questions what it is. In panel 2, we see a little girl. She's skipping rope, saying 1-1-1. Charlie Brown yells out to her, 2, Lucy, 2. Lucy says, still skipping rope, 2-2-2.
Spoiler, this is Lucy.
The first appearance of Lucy Van Pelt. Amazing.
It's amazing, and it's a little different than all the other introductions. It seems like somebody is introduced as, oh, there's a new kid in the neighborhood, or somebody has a new baby brother, and she comes on like she's always been there. So I sort of wonder if there's a missing strip that introduced her.
One thing I was wondering, Michael, was if the very first strip Schulz did of Lucy, now he may have done something and rejected it, but is the March 30th Sunday, given that he worked earlier on the Sundays that had to be processed for color printing through means that were a little more involved than just doing a daily strip, that maybe the March 30th strip is the first thing that he does with Lucy. Now, it still doesn't introduce Lucy. There's not a character saying, this is Lucy, and here's her relationship to the neighborhood. But Lucy is named in the very first panel. And she looks even crazier than she does with this kind of little circle, deer in the headlights circle eye that you see in the last panel of the March 3rd daily strip.
That seemed to be the gag. I mean, Lucy, by the end of the year, she's Lucy. Clearly the fuss budget we love. But he brought her in, again, as a littler kid. She's not a baby. So he likes bringing in little, smaller kid characters so the other kids can act like adults. But he didn't have a personality. So the jokes seem to be about her, these weird googly eyes she has, these unfocused eyes. And
Yeah.
she seems to be really, really attached to her dad. And so there's a bunch we didn't, we're not going to go over them because I didn't think they were all that good or interesting, but she's like really wants to please her dad, and that seems to be the focus.
And I think that's so charming because we don't talk about parents a whole lot in Peanuts, but this is when his adopted daughter Meredith is starting to become verbal. And her saying the words daddy are obviously deeply affecting to Charles Schulz. There's a panel strip just the next day where Lucy's asking for a drink of water, and Charlie Brown is annoyed, saying, "Great Scott, Lucy, can't you see I'm reading?" And then Lucy just looks at him with this little musical voice and hearts floating around her dialogue, saying, "Please." Charlie Brown walks off to the kitchen and he just says, "I've been hypnotized." I think that's the sweetest thing, because
Oh, was it?
that's very autobiographical. You just don't just make up that strip. I mean, that must have been where Schulz was with having a little baby girl.
March 16th. It's a beautifully drawn Sunday strip. It is Patty and Snoopy going for a walk. And she is imagining all the things that Snoopy, the trouble he could get in as they go on this walk. And it ends with Charlie Brown, who is not the dog catcher that they thought he was, holding a butterfly net. That's a terrible description of that, but it's going to be, you're going to have to work with me, people, as we do these Sunday strips. Again, I encourage you to go look at this at gocomics.com or in the Fantagraphics books. Guys, there's some pretty wild drawings and some interesting Snoopy stuff in this strip.
This is one of the weird, this is definitely the weirdest strip of the year. I think Schulz at this point realizes that Snoopy has got to communicate what he's thinking somehow. And it takes him a while to come around to the fact that why don't we just print what he's thinking, the words. We've had a couple of attempts at Snoopy kind of talking. We're saying boo at least. And Schulz said, well, what if Snoopy thoughts were little pictures of what he's thinking.
Yeah,
And
an amazing cartooning technique. Later, like about 50, 60 years later, picked up by Andy Rutten to use in Owly.
okay. Yeah, interesting idea, but it's so bizarre to see
Well, we have to talk about
Snoopy.
what the drawings of Snoopy, with Snoopy is running away from what Patty imagines is the dog catcher. But we actually see end up, it's Charlie Brown with a butterfly net. The first thing we see Snoopy thinking of is himself standing up on his hind legs in a prison outfit, breaking some rocks. He's on a chain gang because he has a ball and chain tied to his rear paw. The next panel, we literally see Snoopy in the electric chair about to be executed. This was, if you're out there and you want a neat little kind of Peanuts curio. A few years ago, Fantagraphics put out for Free Comic Book Day the Unseen Peanuts, I believe it was called. And it was just a Free Comic Book Day comic pamphlet, 32 pages or whatever, that reprinted all of the strips, mostly from, not all of them, but a lot of the strips from the early days that Schulz never wanted to have reprinted in the original books. And this was one of them that I had never seen before. And it blows my mind. First off, how much Snoopy dressed in the prison garb with the rock looks like a character in Mouse. I mean, that
Yes.
looks like it came right out of Mouse.
Yeah, and
Anyone have anything else to say about that?
the electric chair is terrifying because Snoopy is like shaking, visibly shaking when he's thinking of this.
Well, you're projecting that, right? There. Oh no, what he's thinking of. Yeah, you're right. He is. He looks terrified. He's being sentenced to death in his mind.
Yeah. So, I mean, Schulz does some another weird take on Snoopy's thinking process. Luckily, he abandoned this one.
You know, from a drawing standpoint, I love the drawings in this. The drawing of what we first see, the first truck we see, which they believe is the dog catcher's truck, is beautifully drawn. And then the background looks almost like a clear line sort of, you know, Belgian or French comic. And one little just cartooning technique that he does that I love, if you look at the second panel, and you saw this too really clearly in one of the, oh no, we're about to see it really clearly in a strip we're going to talk about soon. But the characters are walking above the ground. Yeah. They're not actually, their feet aren't actually on the ground. They're just sort of floating above it. But it gives it this sort of bounce and this life to them walking that I really enjoy. March 21st, Michael, you want to tell us why this one's important? We see Charlie Brown flying a kite.
Yep. Well, this is the first time, and we don't see the kite hitting a tree, which might be the only time. It's just one of the things we're doing when we're going through these strips is looking for first appearances of some meme that becomes really popular. And certainly Charlie Brown's kite becomes like an epic cliche. And this is the first time.
Yeah. And the kite, Charlie Brown's kite and the kite eating tree is one of the 12 devices that Schultz talks about that really made Peanuts. So an early appearance of this. I think it's funny because Charlie Brown actually can get the kite up in the air, but he's too afraid to let it go all the way up, which actually I relate. When I was a little kid and would fly a kite, I would be terrified if it would go up too high, thinking that it was going to fly away somehow. March 22nd, Charlie Brown and Patty are walking down the street on a clear, cold day. Patty says, "Do you like having me with you, Charlie Brown?" Charlie Brown says in panel two, "Of course. Why?" Patty answers, "I just wondered. You do look happy." In panel three, Charlie Brown says, "It doesn't take much to make me happy." Patty is outraged. In panel four, we see her chasing Charlie Brown. "I always say the wrong thing," he says.
This is a throwback to the early Patty gags from 1950. This was kind of a standard thing where Charlie Brown says something to Patty. He was kind of a wise guy, and he would purposely say something to get her angry, and then she'd end up chasing him or clobbering him.
Yeah, but the difference being this time he didn't mean to say it, which is much more Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
It's the exact same format of the joke, including him running away and her chasing him. But this time it was an accident.
It's pre-rendered again, lots of background detail.
But look how small his head is in the last panel.
Yeah, the head thing is it comes and goes. On some of the other panels, he'll even do, in other strips rather, he'll do some shading on Charlie Brown's head to give it dimension, which is a huge mistake. I think one of the reasons that Peanuts becomes more abstract is really to accommodate the Charlie Brown character design. Because if you start thinking about the actual volume and weight of that head, it's pretty troubling.
One thing that it just fascinates me is when he does a strip that often feels a little bit more autobiographical, it tends to have more detail. And I don't know if that's just me reading into the strip, but it seems like those strips where this may have been based on something that actually happened in real life, all of a sudden you're seeing tree branches and clouds and things that aren't in a typical strip. And I don't know if, and Charlie Brown's head being smaller, just everything moves toward this more realism when it seems like he's telling a joke. And instead of it's a wisecrack from Charlie Brown where he's congratulating himself about something, this is actually something he said that he unintentionally hurts somebody. And it just has so much more depth and feeling to it than just last year's strips.
Yeah. And again, in panel two, we see the characters just hovering a few inches above the ground as they walk. It's just really cute cartooning. I love that. April 4th, a human seeming Snoopy wearing overalls yells at Charlie Brown, who is in front of him on all fours. Snoopy yells, "Speak." Charlie Brown says, "Arf, arf." Panel two, Snoopy sternly says to Charlie Brown, "Sit up." And Charlie Brown does, in the manner of a dog. In panel three, Snoopy says, "Chase it, bring it back," as he throws a ball. And Charlie Brown runs away on all fours to retrieve the ball. In panel four, Snoopy is waking up from what was clearly a dream as Charlie Brown says, "Hey, Snoopy, wake up. I want you to pull me in the wagon."
This is really disturbing.
It really is.
I'm going to have nightmares about this one for a long
You know
time.
What? I will tell you, Snoopy, with his ears puffy like that, wearing the overalls, looks a little like Larry Fine, you know, from Three Stooges.
Well, yes, but of course.
Well, it gives them that the ring of quality hair look. It's just a really troubling thing.
Yeah. Charles Schulz is just now starting into a weird Snoopy ear thing where Snoopy's ears start to look very wonky. He's just on the cusp of getting into that period.
Yeah. This one's like pure Twilight Zone.
It really is.
Scares me.
Yeah, that's what I do.
It's not much of a joke. It really is. Does seem just an attempt for him to see what he can do with Snoopy. And one of the cool and interesting things about the Daily Comic Strip that we've sort of lost, I don't, maybe it's true in web strips, but I kind of don't think so. Well, I know not, is that you could do this in a daily strip and tomorrow it was gone. And sure, okay, there might be a book collection coming out, but you can pick and choose what's going to be in those.
Just the idea that this is such a temporal thing. You're in the newspaper one day and then you're not the next, that Schulz knew he could try things, and if they didn't work, they'd be forgotten. And it wasn't a big deal to play around with this idea of Snoopy and overall speaking. And it's worth the try. You never know. You might do something that resonates. And I really appreciate that he's pushing the boundaries of his own strip and his own rules to see what would work, because we see so many versions of that actually paid off in a huge way for Schulz, because he was willing to try something a little different.
Maybe it'll just be something that three cartoonists look at 70 years later and go, yikes. April 23rd. Violet sits. She looks upset. Charlie Brown is sitting across from her, a book in his hand. He says, "See, this proves it. It says so right here in the encyclopedia." Violet walks away, looking annoyed. Charlie Brown follows her, book under his arm. "Now what have you got to say to that? Huh, smarty? Huh, huh, huh?" he says. Violet turns around, enraged. She yells, "Oh, yeah?" Charlie Brown, in the last panel, is chagrined. He says, well, maybe you're right after all.
This was actually one of my picks, one of my faves of the year. I am the resident violetologist in this group, so I pay attention to her strips, because I think she is the stand-in for Schulz's wife. So this is kind of a domestic scene where, you know, he's reading to her. They're sitting in a living room. Even though, you know, they're acting like kids, you know, with that "oh yeah" retort, this kind of seems like a married couple to me.
It also seems like any two people on the internet today. That is the state of everybody's philosophical, social, and political discourse in 2022.
Yeah, my only note on this strip underneath it in the book, I just wrote, "The Logic of Arguing with Your Spouse."
Right.
May 3rd. Charlie Brown is sitting outside eating some candy. Violet approaches him and says, "You eat too much candy, Charlie Brown." In panel 2, Violet says, "Before you know it, all your teeth will start to decay. Then they'll ache and pain all night long." Panel 3, Violet continues and Charlie Brown looks upset. "Then one day, your teeth will start to fall out. Clink, clink, clink. Then..." Charlie Brown runs away screaming, "Yeah!" By the way, I would just like to say to all our listeners out there, my acting, that's free of charge. That's the bonus you get for listening to this. You're welcome.
We are blessed.
Yes. Oh yeah. As an actor, I'm a great cartoonist.
That's for sure. Yeah, we see here the first appearance, I think it's the first appearance of Ponytail Violet, which is one of the many manifestations of Violet. The Pigtail Violet started out as a very sweet, fun little kid who likes making mud pies and doing things for people. Now she's sort of the spouse stand-in for a bad relationship with Charlie Brown. And Ponytail Violet, who comes and goes, the pigtails come back in soon, is definitely the nagger who's trying to get Charlie Brown's goat.
You think Violet believes in what she's saying, Michael? Or is she just trying to...
She's just trying to freak him out.
Oh,
it's
I
a way
thought
of
she
nag.
really meant
It's a way of nagging too. You know, don't eat too much candy.
I love the use of the wording of that. Your teeth, they'll ache and pain all night long. They'll ache and pain.
That is some old-fashioned language.
It just sounds like it's not Schultz's voice, but he heard somebody actually say it.
Oh, that's something like my grandmother would say. Oh, it's aching and pain in me. May 23rd, three panels of Snoopy dancing around and possibly whistling to himself. Charlie Brown spots him. Snoopy gets embarrassed and walks away. When Charlie Brown says, people shouldn't be embarrassed just because they get caught acting a little silly.
Preach it, Charlie Brown.
Well, I think it's important that Snoopy's got the little lines on his face to indicate he's blushing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real cartoonist staple. I picked this not because it's that funny, but this is kind of a proto later Snoopy. Snoopy, you'll see in a couple of years if you're hanging around, likes to frolic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's doing here is he's frolicking. He's just mindlessly dancing. But later on, he definitely has a dance that he does when he's happy.
Oh, the Snoopy dance, of course, becomes a pop culture meme.
Yeah.
You know, you can get animated GIFs of it to this day.
So I think this is Snoopy learning how to dance.
Yeah. Awesome. This is Charles Schultz giving himself the permission to get silly. Mm-hmm. Go for it, Charles Schultz.
June 1st. This is a Sunday strip. Charlie Brown is walking past Snoopy with an ice cream cone. Uh-oh, he heard me. Snoopy pursues Charlie Brown. I was afraid of this. Snoopy is bouncing around. He really wants to get that ice cream. Get down, Snoopy. Get down. Now he bounds. He's jumping on Charlie Brown. Get down, Charlie Brown says. Patty comes over and says, yelling at him won't do any good, Charlie Brown. Now Snoopy is chasing Charlie Brown around a tree as Patty yells on. And the more you try to get away from him, the more you tantalize him. Charlie Brown is yelling, well, what do you expect me to do? Patty advises, just stand still. Don't let him bluff you. A calm panel. Snoopy sits in front of Charlie Brown, who holds the ice cream cone. And Patty, smiling, says, see, he won't bother you anymore. Snoopy thinks, can this be true? Gulp. He eats Charlie Brown's ice cream cone. Now Charlie Brown is chasing Patty around the tree, saying, just stand still. Don't let me bluff you, as Snoopy finishes the ice cream.
I love this strip so much. I think it works on so many levels. I think both you and I nominated this strip, Michael, because I just find it so funny that Charlie Brown's taking advice from somebody who is an expert on how to dog psychology. As we're watching all this action going on, the cuteness of Snoopy going after the ice cream cone and seeing a lot of different little details of this tree that they're running around. And then when Charlie Brown has been thwarted by the bad advice of Patty, that just the fact that the last panel, Charlie Brown's repeating her own advice to her, like, just stand still, don't let me bluff you, as he's angrily chasing her. I just think it's a brilliant strip and very funny, and reminds me of some of the classic comics like from the 30s that he might have read, some big Sunday strip that might have, you know, I'm not sure which strips I'm thinking of in particular, but it's just brilliantly constructed.
It is like a little dance. It's choreographed, the joke. Which is makes it cute. I think I picked, one reason I did pick is because there was another attempt at giving Snoopy another way of him thinking, except he seems to be talking.
Well, it's interesting because I said thinking because, but what it actually is a hybrid between a thought balloon and a word balloon, which you would sometimes actually see in like superhero comics later that would indicate something like telepathy or whatever. It never works. And, you know, I don't even know how modern readers, how familiar they are with thought balloons, because they were actually banned at DC Comics for decades. But the difference between a word balloon and a thought balloon is a thought balloon has a scalloped edge and usually has little circles pointing to the thinker's head. And a word balloon, it doesn't have a scalloped edge, and it has just a tail, like a pointer, pointing to the person who is speaking. And this is a hybrid between them, because I think he's overthinking it and trying to come up with some sort of dog language. But ultimately, he does just go back to the classic thought balloon.
Just one other thing about this strip is, to me, if Schultz is processing something, he's processing the challenges of coexisting with other people's opinions and needs, right? I mean, his world is now, there are some aggressive personalities in his life, and he's having to deal with them, and he's having to figure out how to live alongside them. And sometimes it doesn't work in your favor to be surrounded by people who have maybe don't pan out to be that accurate.
It's a very difficult strip to draw too, actually, because you have to, like Michael said, it is choreographed, and you have to get the choreography correct. You have to be able to convey some slight, while keeping Snoopy a dog, you have to convey some slight emotion, right? Because he's not attacking Charlie Brown. He's clearly happy and excited by the ice cream cone. Then you have things like running around the tree with Patty in the foreground. It's a lot of thinking that you have to do to make this pretty simple joke work. It's a really nice
a lot example. Of good choices. That with Snoopy chasing Charlie Brown around the tree, Snoopy's front two legs are splayed out 180 degrees from each other. It's just like this little joyous, crazy drawing of Snoopy kind of, it's a representation of him chasing around the tree, but his little paws are so wonky in the drawing. It just makes it extra funny. And then I love that Schultz is able to stack the two drawings visually,
right,
of being chased around the tree, Snoopy chasing Charlie Brown, and then Charlie Brown chasing Patty. It just works so well.
I find the rear view shot of Charlie Brown and the rear view shot of Patty really funny for some reason. I just think they're really funny drawings. June 9th. Patty, Shermy, and Charlie Brown are all dressed up as cowboys with cap guns and hats. Patty says, "I'll be the good guy." Shermy says, "All right, and I'll be the bad guy." In panel 3, Patty says, "What are you going to be, Charlie Brown?" And Charlie Brown says, "I'll be sort of in between. I'll be a hypocrite." Okay.
Definitely one of my favorites.
That's just hilariously funny.
Yeah. Well, later on, one of his characteristics was wishy-washy.
Right.
So maybe later on, but that wouldn't be funny if he says, I'll be wishy-washy.
But it'd be okay, but it wouldn't be as just like dynamite as I'll be a hypocrite. The last word you expect to be in this comic strip with these little kids playing cowboys is hypocrite.
It's just so perfect. And again, it just ties into where Schultz is right now in his life, where he's doing the comic strip, but he's also very involved in his church. And so some of the conversations that are coming out of that part of his life are seeping into this little kid strip in a way like we've never seen before.
Yeah, for sure. And I imagine both factions in Schultz's life, the art school people and the Church of God people, and this, I'm going to use this word, but I don't mean it necessarily in a disparaging way, but are pretty dogmatic. Let's say insular, right? They have their version of the world and it makes sense to them, and that's fine. And Schultz is navigating between these two things. And we, again, on the outside are able to look at it and go, oh, that's wonderful and how well adjusted. And on the inside, he's saying, boy, what a hippie.
And it's like, yeah, draw a hippie, you know?
June 19th, Charlie Brown approaches Lucy, who's standing outside. Charlie Brown says, "That's a nice bunny you have on your dress, Lucy." Lucy says, "I've got a sweater with a tiger on it and a blouse with kitties on it." In panel 3, she continues, "My bed has a doggy on it and my high chair has a teddy bear on it." In the final panel, Lucy says, "All those animals are going to drive me crazy."
I think this is the first time he nails Lucy. Mm-hmm. She's just so negative about everything. So you think, you know, the one thing that makes all little kids happy is animals. But no, Lucy is like, nah, they're driving me crazy. There's too many animals.
One other thing that's interesting, you guys mentioned earlier, Lucy having the saucer eyes, you know, where he would draw the little dot in the middle and then he'd enclose them in a complete circle for the iris and the whites of the eyes. And he gets away from that really quickly. But he does leave these two little commas on either side of her eyes. And only the Van Pelts, I believe, have those as permanent expressions. If they appear on anybody else, it's an indication of some sort of worry, an emotional disturbance that's going on. They have it all the time. And I think that's really interesting. It gives them a little bit of a more neurotic.
And a little bit of, there's an earnestness to the stare of Lucy with that little, what do you call it? The parenthesis.
I called it a comma. It's actually a parenthesis.
Parentheses.
Yeah. But yeah, those eyes just, they're just like these intense, earnest eyes that I think are great. And one of the funny things to me, just in Schultz's life, again, we know that Schultz painted some pretty nice involved murals on the walls of the house, at least in Colorado Springs, and then again in one of the houses in Minneapolis, where the kids were, where the cribs were. And I think one of those walls, I don't know if you saw it when you were at the museum, Jim, but they actually preserved the wall and moved it to the Schultz Museum in Santa Rosa, California, where you can see it. And he did a beautiful tiger, and he does a bunny rabbit that have kind of like wild expression in its eyes.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And I know the guy who owned the house in Minneapolis, and he was telling me the story of how they were preserving that and were going to send it to the museum. So I don't know if that made it there or it's on display yet, but apparently, Keith Abdo was the owner of probably the last house they were in, I'm guessing. And same deal, they went out of their way to basically take what had been on the walls and preserve it and get it over to the museum.
Yeah, I believe it was because I think Schultz actually painted it in oils,
wow,
which is why it was, because it was, had been painted over for decades, and they actually restored it from that. So yeah, it's an amazing thing. So guys, I think we should call it right there. What do you think? 1952, take a break right here and then go back next week and finish up this momentous year in the world of Charlie Brown and Snoopy. What do you think?
Yes, let's do it.
All right. So that's what we're going to do. We'll break it off here. Come back next week if you want to find out what Charlie Brown and the gang get up to in the rest of 1952. And in the meantime, why don't you follow us on our social media accounts, Unpack Peanuts, at both Instagram and Twitter. You can check us out on our website, unpackingpeanuts.com. So until next time, have a good week. For Michael and Harold, this is Jimmy saying thanks for listening and be good. We'll see you next week.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
You blockhead!